Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back to the Thursday edition. Our thanks to Neil Coulong and Ella Abdelnaby for joining us in the opening hour this hour. Tim Brando and Tony Knopp. Suit joins us tomorrow. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Lincoln, Kia, Hyundai, they have the best in new inventory. Great selection of pre-owned inventory, all at the Sunbury Motors Guarantee. A sales staff that works with you because the customer comes first, and a fabulous service department on top of it. It's all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. All right, play-by-play call of the day. Jake Fraley makes a fabulous catch in Seattle.
Paredes clubs this to left field. Fraley leaps in. Fraley made the catch. Are you serious? Shedd gets two. Wow. Unreal.
Double play. A great play by Jake Fraley of the Seattle Mariners last night in Seattle against, or actually that game was in Detroit last night at Comerica Park, and just a great play last night by Jake Fraley in left field for the Seattle Mariners in Comerica. How about that? All right. The legendary Mike Krzyzewski is going to coach one more season at Duke, and then it's going to be John Shire that will take over. Tim Brando has covered Mike Krzyzewski for decades, and is very pleased to welcome in my good friend. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Steve. Heck of a time of year, is it not? And I gather that the long summer will see probably a few more days like this with multiple announcements of guys leaving and career coaches saying I'm out of here, albeit I want to take my victory tour, another lap like Coach K did. It's just that time of year, so it's good to be back with you.
It's great to be back with you. You know, I think you actually set the tone for the next question pretty well. I'm not surprised you did. But but that is, I'm sensing that, because Mike hasn't talked yet, but Brad Stevens, made the move to the Celtics front office today, that the pandemic really kind of did a number on him, especially being in the bubble. I don't know about you, Tim, but everybody I talked to, and you talked to more people than I did, I felt that it really did a number on a lot of coaches this year trying to somehow manage their way through this. What did you sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the whole season for them was like a root canal. It wasn't, it was an endurance test for us, too. And I was one of the fortunate ones that didn't have to do games from his basement or his attic or, from some sterile studio miles and miles away from the game. Many of my colleagues did. But even for those of us that did travel, and I did not have as thick a schedule because of that. Networks made decisions to try to save some money. Everyone was hemorrhaging money this past year. So if you were going to be calling games on the road, you probably weren't going to do as many. And so that was the case with me. I probably did about half my normal schedule, but at least I was there. And in the conversations that we had with the coaches, always from distance now, I was never on the floor with one of them. I think I walked into the Rock at Seton Hall at the same time the Villanova team was coming in. And so we went through security about the same time, and I was able to see Jay Wright, face-to-face from 6 feet, but face-to-face. We were Zooming all the time, and it was a pain in the butt for everybody, And I think that coaches that were dealing with their players and the anxiety that comes from waking up every morning, getting swabbed at 7:30, you know, in some leagues they were doing it every day, you know, some, and in other leagues they were doing it every third day. It was just a pain. And, you know, that was true in basketball. In football, you know, you had position coaches that didn't, and position players that didn't see their teammates until game day. You know, they were that distant from one another. So imagine trying to coach your team when your team is never really together until they come out, you know, for a Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, it definitely played a role in I think, all of the decisions that we've seen made to this point. Some more than others, probably, because of maybe some past issues that they've had. Like, I figured this announcement was going to come from Mike very soon. Right. After both decisions were made, number one by Kevin White as athletic director of Duke to step down when he did last year. And then when Roy Williams made his decision, I'm like, Mike cannot be far behind.
Well, what a career he's had, obviously. You know, look, we know about the five national titles and the three gold medals, and he was also an assistant on the Dream Team as well in 92. Mm-hmm. But look, this is something where you and I can talk about this because I think you and I have been very fortunate that in at our age, we've seen so much that we can lend some perspective to. If Mike Krzyzewski had gone through his first 3 years at Duke in the 20-teens and not when he did in the late 70s and early 80s, would he have survived?
No, not even close. And that story about athletic director Tom Butters and Mike is... you know, it's just incredible. There was one, I think, other example of that, and it actually happened with one of Mike's closest friends, one of his closest friends, P.J. Carlissimo. He was in a situation at Seton Hall where they were about to make the move on him, and to the credit of a lot of people, the late Larry Keating being one of them, who passed away, and Larry, of course, went on to Kansas afterwards, I think he may have been in a similar situation. And, of course, he took them to the greatest height Seton Hall's ever had, getting to the finals. And were it not for the John Clockerty call on the block charge to send Ramil Robinson to the free throw line, might have won a national title. But Mike, that story was just, I mean, Krzyzewski thought he was done. Butters is like, I've got to do it. I'm going to give you this contract extension. And Krzyzewski was in tears. He thought, you know, you don't have to do this. They were ready to run him out on a rail. Now, people forget, I mean, yes, you think Duke now, and you think Mike Krzyzewski, period. Krzyzewskiville, Coach K Court, all that. You know, they had gone to the Final Four and to the national championship game and lost with a team that was outstanding. Mike Jeminski, my colleague, was on that team with Jimmy Spadarkel. And then lost their coach, lost her to South Carolina, you know, because Duke wasn't at that particular point willing to pay the freight. A job in the Metro Conference at that time at South Carolina was worth more than the Duke job was. So they had had great success. Duke was a proud program for a long period of time, 50s, 60s. And then again that late run at 1978, and they go into the tank, and he had to resurrect them. But they knew they were in trouble when Mike took over. His first year was the best of his first three, and the second two were awful. And I mean, he would not have lasted in today's environment. No question about it. Yeah. He would have been gone.
Yeah, it was that Jack Givens had the 41 for Kentucky when they beat.
Point game,
So now we get you have to have a class that then establishes not just winning but your culture. Jay Billis, Mark Allery, Johnny Dawkins, they got Gene Banks out of Philly. What do you think they meant to then allowing Mike to not only just win, which was obviously critical, but then to then get that word culture in place that he wanted to have?
Well, you know, Kenny Dennard played on Mike's team, and Jaminski did not, but Dennard did, Banks did, Spinarkel and G-Man were both gone. But the willingness to bring them into the fold and to make them feel as though he needed them, even those that didn't play for him, all right, including Jaminski, was important to Mike because he knew he needed as many friends as he could have after the first three seasons. Yeah. And he always asked them back. It was that, you know, that culture. And Mike was adamant about the fact that he wanted staff members, by and large, to be guys that were former players, guys that played for him, stayed within the culture. You know, he only had Pete Gaudette and Mike Bray.
Right.
Were the only two coaches that he had that were not former players for him.
Right.
Everybody else that he had on his staff played for him at some point. And most of them point guards, yeah, or two guards.
Right,
but
yeah.
The reality is that that was the key, I think, when times were really downtrodden, that that he was able to reach out and not alienate some of the veteran players that he inherited. Listen, Denard was still is one of his most staunch supporters.
Yep.
You know, he would buy 500 tickets for the Duke Carolina game at Duke every year. And it was a good sound business decision for him too. But let me say, and I mean this sincerely, Steve, I've been at this for four decades. I started in 1985 in the ACC, and that was also the same year I started at ESPN. But I had been calling college basketball since 1982. So I'm looking at the regional level before I got to the national level, and a lot of that time was spent in the SEC and ACC. And I mean, my timing could not have been any better. You had Valvano coming to NC State. You had Mike at Duke. You had Bobby Crimmins at Georgia Tech. In the SEC, you had proud programs beyond just Kentucky. You know, you had Dale Brown at LSU. You had Nolan Richardson coming in, Freddie Sutton at Arkansas. Yeah. I mean, it was just the golden age of college basketball in so many ways was during that period in which I came into as a young broadcaster at 29 years of age. And for those of us that have gotten to know and created a level of trust with these guys, it's the end of an era. I mean, it's a sad day for guys like me that have always dealt with coaches of different ages. But these were guys that were already there, that were just a little bit older than me. Just, not a lot, but a little. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike is 75. I'm 65. This is a time when, especially with college basketball's popularity on the wane, and it has been really for 10 to 15 years. The regular season has been moved to the back pages. It seems that only the tournament is covered, even by those in network television that have so much programming of college basketball, don't talk about it at all during the regular season. It's only like, the 2 weeks before, you know, who's in, who's not in. You know, the only thing you get is bracketology talk, and then the tournament starts. College basketball is in the depths of despair with attention, and the ratings have shown that. The coaches were the ones that were most coveted in terms of the sport's popularity. And as these coaches from this generation leave the game, I wonder now where we're going to go, what we're going to see. And I think a lot of them are leaving the game, not because of their health, but because the damned sport has done so much damage to itself, and it's so hard to manage a program now off the court with the decisions that they are impacted by that they have no control over in the NBA. And with that in mind, you know, Mike was on the receiving end of some good aspects of it. You know, had Jerry Colangelo not reached out to him, you know, after Chuck Daly was coach, and he not have been the Olympic coach, I think that extended Mike's career probably, you know, you can argue 5 to 10 years, certainly helped getting the recruits to win another national championship. But of that group, all the coaches that you've seen say goodbye, I think the mismanagement of college basketball in some strange ways that Billy Packer was talking about before he stepped aside. He saw the problem coming, and a lot of people wouldn't listen. You know, people blame college basketball for one and done. It's not college basketball.
No.
It's the NBA Players Association that forced that on people. And Mike tried his best to get the NCAA to listen. In the mid-90s, he went to the meet with the NCAA, and they basically just laughed him out of the room. And his health was impacted by it. He had to take the year away. That was when he had the issues with his back back in 1995. He really wanted to help the game. And then ultimately he just threw his hands up and said, okay, if you can't beat them, join them. I'll start getting one and dones, and I'll coach him up that way. And because he was the USA coach, that helped him tremendously in getting that top-tier talent to sort of steal the thunder from John Calipari in many ways.
Yeah, exactly right, because of that association with USA Basketball. And, of course, they won the gold in 8, 12, and 16.
Right.
And it's interesting how, for example, the pros gravitate toward Mike, but also the USA Basketball connection helped him with one-and-done recruits. There's no question about that.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure. Now, listen, I haven't talked to Mike. We're good friends. I have not talked to him, and I probably won't for quite a while. But, you know, he was and is the genuine article, and we do have a great deal of trust and a strong relationship. The last year that I was involved in ACC basketball, I tweeted about this earlier today, Mike Javinsky and I got to call. For years, Raycom Sports always did the first game between Duke and North Carolina in syndication.
Right.
And ESPN took it around the rest of the country, but they were blacked out in that area. In recent years, it was the opposite. ESPN got the rights, didn't have to buy the rights from Raycom. But we continued doing those games and the tournament through the year 2019. In the final year, I knew this would be my last game. Mike Krzyzewski and Kevin White and John Jackson, who worked so closely with Mike, they knew this would probably be the last time I ever came into the building to call a game at Cameron. And it had been probably 15 to 20 straight years of doing it. And they got center court seats five rows up, mid court, for my entire family, my grandchildren, my children.
Wow.
And so he's a sweetheart, a good man.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I started doing Penn State in 82, so we started right around the same time. And when they transitioned to the Big Ten in 93, it's Bob Knight, Lou Henson, Gene Katie, Judd Heathcote, right? I mean, it's not, and you and I both know it's not that way anymore.
Tom Izzo's a legend. He's a Hall of Famer, and he's also my age. You know, Tom is my age, and I don't know, you know, how much longer he's going to go. He would be, you know, probably in that next wave of guys that are sort of carrying the banner for, you know, the rock star coaches that have had NBA opportunities every year. You know, Jay Wright is a few years younger than me, but that's the next group coming. We've seen. I mean, when I started doing college basketball on ESPN in 1985, Terry Holland had Dave Odom and Jim Larrañaga on his staff.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Think about that.
I know.
Steph Greenberg was a GA on that staff.
Yep.
So that's going back a ways, and it just makes you think. I would be running around airports, running into Izzo, out on recruiting trips, you know, through the Chicago airport, you know, running from, you know, one flight to another, and he's gone on to become a Hall of Famer ever since. Those were the glory years, really, of college basketball. John Wooden was the most successful, no question about it. But in terms of the growth and popularity and the strength of college basketball. Really, the ground floor was its exposure on cable television. As cable television emerged, so did college basketball. And that's when the tournament really began to be a much bigger deal everywhere. So Wooden was enormously successful, but the competition for Mike to get through it and to get through tournaments with 48, then later 64, and 68 teams versus John Wooden, the Wizard, with 16 and then later 32. I mean, think about that. It's a little bit harder to accomplish really what Mike did in his era of college basketball, and he's certainly the closest thing to John Wooden that we had in this business with a pulse.
My gosh, I enjoy every conversation we have. Thank you so much for your time today, especially on such a busy day, Tim. Appreciate you very much.
Thank you, Steve. A pleasure being with you. Going down memory lane there.
Thanks, Tim.
You bet.
Tim Brando, Tony Knott, next half hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Final half hour of today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. Tony Knott, my good friend, joins us from Los Angeles. Tony, my friend, welcome back. It's been far too long.
My goodness, how time changes. Since the last time we talked, we're going to have full fans for some fun games.
The NHL is now expanded, so Seattle comes in, which means they've received about $1.15 billion in expansion fees from both Vegas and Seattle combined.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the NBA and Major League Baseball going the expansion route because of quick cash capability?
The problem, yes, but not the same between the two of them. The labor issues with baseball are so bad, I think they're going to have a hard time pushing through bulk expansion, especially considering what they just did with minor league baseball and, you know, cutting a number of teams and cutting some spending there. I think there is a big labor talk that's going to happen with baseball prior to an expansion, and I think you could see Oakland relocate, right? Oakland could end up in Vegas. I think basketball has been laying the groundwork for that for quite a while. I think what the NBA has done so well is they're starting to mimic the success that the Premier League's had in having the G League and in having, you know, these cities that they can almost test for a little while before they turn them into, you know, premium cities that host an NBA team. But I think the NBA's labor situation, because they have revenue sharing, is so much easier for them, and their labor piece is a little bit better right now. I think they have a lot better prospects for moving into expansion than baseball does. But look, both, I mean, you cite the money that the Seattle Kraken got, and you cite the money that the Las Vegas Golden Knights got, but, I mean, the DC United was just valued at $700 million. So there's definitely an expansion fee boom out there. The question is just how many billionaires are there that can buy the team in today's environment? Because now it's not just a question of, is there a billionaire who can do it? Is there a billionaire who's not going to upset the populace, the players, and the labor force?
And that's, and again, you look at the group that was put together by Alex Rodriguez to buy the Minnesota Timberwolves. They're right. Not talking about keeping them in Minneapolis. They're talking about sending them to Seattle, which has been a prime bargaining chip in the NBA to get better arenas that if you don't go, you can go to Seattle, just like the NFL used Los Angeles. Is that correct?
Yeah, and look, that argument, that bargaining chip has only gotten stronger with the wild success of the Kraken. The Seattle Kraken sold out quickly and easily. More importantly, the corporate sponsorships they had there sold out quickly and at high levels. They are doing a very good job of kind of mimicking what happened in Las Vegas. We'll see what they do with the expansion draft. I think they made the Golden Knights a little too good too fast. They might pull back on that gas pedal a little bit.
Yes.
But I think that that's what's going to happen. I think, you know, there's so much success in Las Vegas and Seattle that even if you move the Minnesota Timberwolves to Seattle, you now have Las Vegas as your bargaining chip, which the A's are already using. Vegas has a NBA-ready arena. They have everything that you need as far as facilities, and now you've already had the NHL and the NFL go into the city, which eliminates the stigma of sports betting around it. So, yes, they've been using the Seattle chip for quite a long time. I think they might actually cash that chip now because they have Vegas in their back pocket. And Nashville is growing as a city that people are considering for, you know, those live events because the Predators have been so strong and the Titans have done pretty well.
Yeah, no question. All right, so now let's continue on the cash mode. Yahoo Sports and Pete Thamel reporting today something you and I have talked about, and as you know, I brought up the idea of 12 in the college football playoff back in December. Athletic departments, for the most part, were running eight-figure losses for the past fiscal year.
Yeah.
There aren't many avenues to make it up. Is the college football playoff, once this contract is up, a way to start making that up?
Yes, and there are some ways for them to make it up. Sports betting, cannabis, those sorts of things that are going to be the slowest into college sports for every reason that we could all imagine. There are different venues or different avenues for them. NFT, crypto, there's new sponsorship channels that are opening up that are going to make them some money. But in the end, you know, you want to take the money. And just to make this as simple as possible, because I'm sure we'll talk about the Olympics in a second too, which is exactly what's happening there. All that's really happening is these schools are saying, why are we enriching the bowl games, right? We're disrupting. We're making it so that the bowls are no longer standalone. They're starting to be consolidated into a college football playoff. And then we have a little bit more democratic way of spreading money around so that this isn't, you know, a handful of schools. You can actually involve more schools, and therefore the rising tide raises all boats. Because if you have more teams in contention, you have more teams that can make money throughout the year. Because I think what the common fan doesn't pay attention to is they think, I don't need to see Central Florida in the playoff. I don't want to watch them play Alabama. But you probably do want to watch them play more than you would if they're going to the playoff in their games in November and December.
Exactly.
And that's what college football is looking at.
See, we think the same way. I bet that's exactly what you and I were talking about. All right,
yeah. They're not looking at this and saying, we think the first round of the college football playoff is going to be super exciting. I hope it is, and maybe it is, right? I mean, none of us thought that Ohio State was going to win the title in the first year of the college football playoff when they had their third-string quarterback show up, and they did, right? And that team wouldn't have played in the old BCS formula.
But exactly right.
This comes down to how much more money can I drive out of regular season games? And this enables you to drive more money. It's the same exact thing that the NBA did with the play-in tournament.
Now, we get to the Olympics. Is this a come hell or high water deal for them? Because NBC sounds to me like they've told everybody, they're going. It's go time.
They're going. It's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening because the IOC holds all the cards. Nobody can stop them. All of these contracts are guaranteed. They're going to get their money one way or the other. And, you know, if we've learned anything from watching the IOC or FIFA or any of those international organizations over the last few decades, they care about money and nothing else. And that's what's going to happen. They're going to say, look, you need to fill our coffers. Our contracts say that this is going to happen, so it's going to happen. And they are in a dicey situation. And look, they did it to themselves when you piggyback Beijing on Tokyo, because now you have a threat in Beijing of sponsors saying maybe we can't be as active. I mean, there's not going to be any boycotts, but there's probably going to be some kind of activism while you're there. So if you're the Olympics, you're really not looking at another big payday until Paris. I mean, Milan is a great city, but summer games are triple what the winter games are as far as economic impact goes. And so I think it happens either way. And I think it just happens because the offseason doesn't happen. That's it, right? I mean, look, we want our money. We're gonna run the games.
Does this open the door to Tokyo getting 2032 as a makeup?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, what was interesting that happened in our space over the last couple of weeks was, and we've known about it for months, that Endeavor won the bid for the hospitality contract for Milan, Paris, and Los Angeles. They bid $1.6 billion on that. And the next bid was $1.3 billion, and that was NBC. So for those who think that the Olympics are slowing down, it isn't. There's more money coming out of it, and they're disrupting what's happening with all of the different providers that are out there. If you're going to have that big a bid, and you're going to show enough value into that bid as we start going into the games, right? Because their first games is going to be Milan. Paris. They're going to start to want to show that there's success here, and then you want to dangle that next carrot of the next package of games. And Tokyo is a sure thing. I mean, the one thing Tokyo really had going for it prior to COVID hitting was we were seeing just bonkers numbers as far as on sales for pricing, for demand, for hotels, for all of it. I mean, Tokyo was going to set every record under the sun. So they'd be crazy not to go back there in 2032 and try to get what they were hoping to get in 2020.
Yeah, because that's what I've thought. It was a makeup opportunity because essentially that's about what they did with Paris and L.A. They said, look, they both bid for in 24, so they just split them, gave one 24, the other 28.
Yeah, they're 28. And look, it's not there's no precedence for this. I mean, I know it's summer versus winter, but Beijing was 2008, and now it's 2022. That's a 14-year split, right? This is a 12-year split. It's not unheard of.
No, it's not unheard of. Exactly right. The fans will probably not be able to go. So what does that do? Now, look, the driver's TV, and NBC is the biggest driver of all. But does that do anything to the games in terms financially? What kind of blow is it that they're, you know, we all know in Major League Baseball, you need 40% of the gate. The NBA is about 35%. Yeah. What do the Olympics need normally?
Well, the vast majority of the Olympics revenue comes from rights and sponsorships, so they'll do just fine. But yes, the ticket sales generally drives the local governing bodies a little bit better. So, you know, when you are the way the Olympics works, I'm not going to go into too much detail on it, but the way the Olympics works is a lot of the ticketing is actually given out to each one of the countries, and the countries have their own organizations that they sell tickets through. And for total disclosure, we help sell tickets for, I think it's like 40 countries now. So it's going to hurt the country's governing bodies, the USOC, the SOPC, you know, Australia's governing body, more than it's going to hurt the actual event itself. Like, they do have the economic impact of it that you can imagine, but it also hurts all the local countries when you don't have the ability to sell the tickets into the customers. And so I think there's still going to be sponsorship for it. I think, unfortunately for all of us, as if we haven't had enough politics over the past couple of years, I think the Tokyo games and the Beijing games are going to be the most political games we've seen in 30 years.
I agree with you about that.
The Tokyo ruling party, I mean, look, the general public does not want to host the games. They've been very vocal about it. I mean, every survey out there, 65 to 70% say this shouldn't happen, and they're going to lose more money on it. And then in Beijing, you know, there's a belief that, you know, many of those who are in power now, you know, one of the crowns in their throne is that they were so successful with the Beijing Games of 2008, and this is an opportunity for, you know, the challenging party to pull that throne or to pull that crown out as well by making 2022 a dud. So, just get ready for a lot of very politically skewed stories around these two games.
Yeah, no question. In fact, Beijing, there's been talk of boycotts. And look, I know two athletes personally that were in the 80 boycott. You know athletes, as well.
They're the only ones who got hurt.
Exactly right. They're the only ones that got hurt were the participants.
Yeah. I don't think we'll see boycotts, but I think we'll see activism of some kind. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out because they don't have patience for that in China. I was there for the Beijing Games in 08 for a month. I've seen how they do things from, you know, behind the curtain. And it's they don't have the same rules and the same belief in rights as we do.
I never would have known that. That's nuts.
Yeah. It was. I saw some things happen there that I just, you know, there's stories that we tell over drinks about suitcases full of money and automatic weapons, and it was just crazy. It was everything that you thought it would be in a corrupt international event was right in front of me.
Of the sports in this country, which do you think will come out of the pandemic in pretty good shape? And I'll throw one out there. Now, we know the NFL will. So besides that.
Yeah, I was going to say, the NFL is the easy one.
Yeah, that's the easy one. My guess is, I think MLS comes out of this in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Well, what helps the MLS the most is the labor piece that they came to last summer. You know, what a lot of fans don't understand is a lot of these economics are really impacted by employee costs. Employee costs is, you know, the stars and the athletes. The NBA is driven by a lot more ticketing revenue than most people understand. So when you don't have fans for that long, the revenue that's being shared is difficult. And now you're going to have another conversation about what kind of revenue share there is. And the next time you do a collective bargaining agreement, there's going to be you're going to have a very long argument over force majeure, right? What is force majeure? What happens if the pandemic shuts it down? Because now we have precedence for this, that it's happened. And that puts them in a precarious position because that happens with their sponsors too. What MLS did, which is very well, I mean, first of all, MLS is an outdoor sport, which is very helpful. Not as a contact sport like the NFL. It's growing significantly. And most importantly, they have labor peace right now. And, you know, their feeder systems are very strong. They made a move the other day that most people wouldn't have noticed that might have slipped underneath the radar, where they're starting to create a minor leagues that playing into the MLS. So they're starting to create this system. The only question with the MLS is going to be how them being separated from the men's national team and women's national team's media rights is going to impact them, because there was some belief that because those deals were packaged, MLS was getting more money. I don't, you know, since we just saw, you know, the DC United valued at $725 million, I don't think that's a concern. But who knows, right? But I do think the MLS is in a really strong position. So is the NHL. I mean, look, for all the mistakes the NHL has made over the last 20-something years,
Not the last 18 months.
Yeah, I mean, the Kraken and Golden Knights were wild successes. And the product in the ice has been good. They have young stars. They have labor peace. Look, I mean, I was a casualty of the lockout of 2004. I was working for the LA Kings at that point. Yep. And then they had another one. But look, when you come out of those wars and you have labor peace and you have a framework for that labor peace, and now the pandemic happens to come out of it, again, the one thing that costs you the most money, that's the most variable, which is, or the most delicate, which is labor, you have solved where the other leagues don't. That's a good spot to be in.
Okay. Gary Bettman, to his credit, Tony, said, "We're not going to go back until you, the players, tell me you're ready. If you say we're ready on July 20th, we'll go July 20th. If you think you can't be ready till August 10th, we'll go August 10th. Mm-hmm. It was like one of those, like, wow, this guy learned. And then they struck a four-year extension of their deal with the players to go with new TV deals with ESPN, Turner.
Yeah, they're back on the big names again, right?
Yeah. So now, one final question. All right, now let's go to something that's near and dear to both of our hearts. How well does college sports, football, men's basketball, come out of this? And how much time does it take to really come out of it in such a way where all sports are helped?
I think the money college sports, and that doesn't necessarily mean basketball or football, because it depends on what school you're at, right? I mean, college basketball at some schools drives an inordinate amount of revenue, whereas at like a USC or a Penn State, it's an also-ran to the football team. You know, those football teams are running $800 million budgets. College football had its own problems going into the pandemic, and I think the pandemic weakens it significantly. I think, you know, the passing of the NIL and the further empowerment of college athletes, which I'm totally aligned with, and I know you are too, is going to create a circumstance where, you know, There's an interesting book a couple of years ago written by Kevin Kelly that talks about that most wealth isn't created, it's just moved. Like when you talk about something that disrupts an industry, all you're doing is moving money from one side to the other. And yep. And that's what's going to happen is there's this pressure on the college institutions as the money is starting to be moved from them into the athletes' coffers and into those that are around the athletes. And a lot of that money that's, you know, the dark money that, you know, the $180,000 that goes to Cam Newton, that stuff comes to light and you start to get value. So I think right now we're in a place where you're trying to create a consolidation of, you know, universities with the college football playoff at the same time that you're creating super leagues that are even less tied together than they've ever been, right? The Big Ten is so healthy. The SEC is so healthy. The Pac-12 is teetering. The ACC is on its back. The Big East collapsed. Like, you know, we're really moving towards, and, you know, I apologize to the listeners that I often point towards European soccer, but European soccer has just been around longer as a commercial concern. So a lot of the things that they've experienced, we just are kind of moving our way towards. I worry that college football is moving in the direction of like Italian soccer or Spanish soccer as opposed to European, as opposed to English soccer, where the lower tier teams are just, they cannot compete, right? They don't have the firepower. They don't have the facilities. I think Penn State will be fine. I think USC will be fine. I think the big schools will be fine. I think you're going to have a real problem with the tier two college football programs because if they can't get through the next 2 years, and they might not be able to make it, you know, if they're not getting those TV contracts, if they don't have an opportunity to, you know, be anything but, you know, served up 3 days a week, 3 days a year, it's going to create an environment that might not be all that compelling to watch.
My friend, I thoroughly enjoy it. Need to do this more often, okay?
Yeah, for sure. We're coming up on whiskey already. You guys got a great opener.
I know. You texted me about that, and that I can't wait. Are you going to go?
I might. Dave's trying to get me to go, so we'll see.
The great Tony Knopp, back tomorrow here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.